Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Karen Russell about her first novel, Swamplandia.
Polymorphous is the word because I think the swamp is also a physical setting that corresponds to these characters' grief in the wake of their mother's death.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Lee Siegel discusses the dark side of the internet.
The dark side is that rather than creating freedom, it constricts or even abolishes freedom because the internet can be used even more effectively, according to Muratsov, by repressive regimes.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Devoted readers of fiction, and that includes many of our listeners, will be familiar with the name Karen Russell. She's emerged as one of the major young writers of our time, and her first novel has been published. It's called Swamplandia. It's reviewed for us by a prize-winning writer, Emma Donahue, her first ever review for the Book Review, who says that it is vividly worded, exuberant in its characterization, and the novel is a wild ride. I'm delighted that Karen Russell is here to talk about her book. Welcome.
Hi, Sam.
Okay, so we've got alligators and families and kind of bizarre fantasy worlds they inhabit. So tell us about it.
Swamplandia is a story of the Big Tree Tribe. It's a group of non-Miccosukee, non-Seminole, white transplants to Florida who live on the island, Swamplandia, about 40 miles from Loomis County, which is sort of an exaggerated version of South Florida, contemporary South Florida. The novel opens in the wake of the death of their headliner, Hilola Bigtree. She's sort of the matriarch of the clan, and she's also the star draw of tourists to Swamplandia. So sort of the tourists are defecting to a new mega corporate franchise park, the World of Darkness, that's opened up on the mainland. The Big Trees act is sort of, you know, in dissolution without their headliner. Ava Bigtree, who is the novel's protagonist, she's 13 and she's off on a quest to save her family.
And where do the alligators come in?
Well, the alligators, this family refers to them as Seths because tradition is as important as promotional materials are expensive. So they have 98 alligators. And the Swimming with the Seth show is their huge draw. This was performed by their mother, Hilola Bigtree, recently deceased. So there's a gator pit full of these creatures in Ava's backyard.
Karen, our reviewer, Emma Donahue, who's also an accomplished literary scholar, sees different layers of meaning in your novel, and particularly in the idea of the swamp. Let me read you something that she wrote and ask you to comment on that. The landscape itself is a polymorphous symbol for the ambiguities of adolescence, as well as for other disasters. Is she right about that?
Yeah, I love that line, and I think that is such a great reading. Polymorphous is the word because I think the swamp is also a physical setting that corresponds to these characters' grief in the wake of their mother's death. There's these sawgrass prairies that go on limitlessly without horizon. And I think Ava moving through them is, in a real way, moving through the landscape of her own grief. But I also do think, you know, so much of the novel is concerned with these characters trying to settle on a way of seeing. So they're sort of, one of them, Osceola, her mom is gone. She's decided that she is a psychic spiritist. She can communicate with the world of the dead. She goes way off the deep end and is sort of looking to the occult for these consoling stories. Kiwi, Ava's brother, decides that he's going to be a genius on the mainland. He's a bookish kid and he wants to make it in the real world outside of Swamplandia. And I think Ava is sort of caught between these two ways of seeing, and the swamp, it really is an uncanny realm. You know, it's neither land nor water. So it seemed like the right place to stage a girl's coming of age.
Well, to quote Donahue again, she says almost a gothic quality to the world you're describing. And that you've done in a very conscious way.
I'm happy to be part of a tradition that includes sort of Flannery O'Connor and Catherine Dunn and folks who infuse their whimsy with some darkness. That was a balance I was trying to strike in it. It definitely seemed appropriate for the Everglades, which is sort of irreducibly mysterious. If you go out there, there are, you know, these primordial monsters just swimming around, acres of sawgrass, mangrove labyrinths that look like something out of Borges, you know, just a funhouse of trees. It's very Seussical and wild and weird down there, and it is very Gothic.
Now, Karen, although you're only 29, you've actually been working with this material or some of it for quite a number of years now, a famous short story published in Zoetrope. How did you find this topic?
I think it found me. I'm from Miami, and I definitely visited roadside attractions very similar to Swamplandia. Miami's sort of the most jungles, most artificial jungles per capita in the country. We've got Parrot Jungle, Monkey Jungle, the Miami Seaquarium. So I think that sort of it's been in my bloodstream, this really strange division, these artificial places where there are real monsters.
Thanks a lot, Karen.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Karen Russell, whose first novel, Swamplandia, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So we're hearing at last from Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes, after many years of being pretty quiet since leaving the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld is out with a memoir. Actually, it officially comes out on Tuesday, but on Thursday, several newspapers, including the New York Times, wrote stories about the memoir after they obtained early copies.
So what's the news? Is there any news in it?
There is some news. First of all, it's an incredibly long book. It's about 800 pages, which might give you some sense of what he's been doing all these years. But he does focus, of course, on his time in the Bush administration, but he really goes back several decades. He talks about his personal life, about his son who struggled with drug addiction.
Julie, a lot of people will want to know what Rumsfeld has to say so many years later about the invasion of Iraq and his partnership with George W. Bush. Any insights there?
He does discuss that at length. He recalls when on the morning of 9/11, when he was in his office and at the Pentagon and felt the building shudder. He talks about 2 weeks after 9/11, when President Bush asked him to review and revise war plans for Iraq. He also talks about his mistakes, although he doesn't really say that there were that many of them, but he does mention that the 2002 memo, which became quite famous later, in which he said, "I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why is standing limited to 4 hours?" And he was discussing stress techniques in interrogations. But he said that he regretted writing that note, that it was a mistake to write that memo. But he didn't really get into a lot of the score settling that administration figures have gotten into in the past in this kind of memoir. He does reserve quite a bit of criticism for Condoleezza Rice and for Paul Bremer and for Colin Powell, which might not surprise too many people.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
The more we use the internet, the more complicated it seems to become, especially on great issues of politics and morality and ideology. There's a new book out. It's called The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom by Evgeny Muratsov. It's reviewed for us by the great critic Lee Siegel, who has ideas of his own about the internet and its vices and virtues, and he's here to talk about it. Welcome, Lee.
Nice to be here, Sam.
Okay, so what is Muratsov's argument? What's the dark side of the internet?
The dark side is that rather than creating freedom, it constricts or even abolishes freedom, because the internet can be used even more effectively, according to Muratsov, by repressive regimes, for example, or non- or anti-democratic groups like Russian neo-fascists. His central example is the Iranian regime, which crushed the so-called Green Revolution, partly by appropriating the technology that had fomented or helped foment the revolution. Subterfuge, deceitful text messaging, deceitful and manipulative Facebook posts, texting the population into a kind of counter-revolutionary paranoia, gathering information on the protesters about their identities and so forth on Facebook. All of this helped to crush the revolution. But what Muratsov points out is that, and what really exercises him in this book, is that in the West, there is what he called a digital orientalism. Skeptical, worldly Western commentators when they become like romantic children when they consider technology in the hands of in the context of repressive regimes. For them, technology can only have a positive, benevolent meaning in those contexts. And for Morozov, that's simply not so.
And tell us about him. Who is he?
He's a 26-year-old immigrant from Belarus. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's been running a very smart stuff about technology for some years now. He's quite the astringent and caustic contrarian. He came to some prominence when Malcolm Gladwell quoted him in Gladwell's skeptical piece about social media that he published in The New Yorker I think it was October.
Oh, that was the essay in which Gladwell said that Twitter and Facebook and such can't really propel the kind of social movements that people sometimes think they do.
Right. He said that they were not a natural enemy of the status quo. Coming from someone I think who is a natural ally of the status quo, that caused widespread debate.
And what about Cairo in Egypt? Do we have any sense? Has Morozov been commenting on this? Have you been following it closely? And what conclusions do you draw about the influence of the internet?
Well, it's very interesting. Almost as soon as protests erupted in Cairo, Roger Cohen attacked Morozov in a column in the Herald Tribune, which appeared online at the New York Times website, called Morozov's book an ill-timed book, dismissed him as a rumpled and bespectacled 26-year-old who was dead wrong, he said. Cohen exemplified what Morozov would call the cyber-utopian view that social media was going to affect, finally, a democratic revolution in Cairo. But events moved very quickly, and obviously social media is not sufficient, alas, to bring about a democratic regime. All Mubarak had to do was virtually flick a switch and turn off internet services, and now it's really back to a fairly primitive confrontation between pro-Mubarak government-sponsored protesters charging into the anti-government crowd on horseback and camel. I don't think social media is playing that great a role. And, of course, it has been used, as reporters have noted, by the regime itself.
And, Lee, you wrote an important book on the internet a few years ago. How does your analysis then seem to you? Would you revise anything you wrote, or do you think you kind of got it right?
I'm sorry that I didn't emphasize the political aspect. I barely touched on that, and Morozov has developed it in what I think is almost an encyclopedic, comprehensive book. It's really the levels of argument that he has going are really impressive, and I'm sorry that I didn't do that. What I did do was suggest that the disconnectedness of the internet is something that is not conducive to social movements.
What kind of evidence does Morozov draw on? How does he make this very cogent argument or this series of arguments?
It's a comprehensive book. He seems to have followed the internet in just about every country. So he's got evidence that Japanese neo-fascists are using it to persecute minorities in Japan. Russian neo-fascists are using it to organize pogroms. He even quotes a critic of Chavez in Venezuela, twittering Chavez and asking him if he's a dictator. And Chavez tweeting back and saying, no, Mariana, I'm anti-dictator. He's very alive to the way this technology is used by these very canny dictators. He says that we think of villains, people like Mubarak, because they're bad, we think of them in a one-dimensional, cartoonish kind of way. But of course, these people are bad. They're complex people who have some positive attributes like intelligence and guile. And they are, Morozov's point, using evidence from Iran, from China, these regimes are very handily using social media to crush social media, in a sense.
Is there an impasse between the forces of evil or repression and the forces of good liberation, or is there a solution? Is there a way for the internet to reclaim its place as this liberating force in our lives?
Well, he kind of airily says so at the end of the book. There is always at the end of every book, there has to be the solution at the end of the book. You know, if you publish a book on any social problem, at some point the editor will say to you, can we end on a positive note, you know? And he does attempt to do that. He doesn't, maybe to his credit, he doesn't really have anything concrete to say. I do think that at times he's too pessimistic, and he underestimates the resourcefulness on the other side, the resourcefulness of creative people committed to democracy who can get around curbs put on the internet by hostile regimes. For example, there is a way to store your data not on your hard drive, but on the internet itself. It's called in the cloud. And Morozov says, well, but even that's not going to work because the bad guys can get a hold of the systems administrator and torture the password out of him. But that's really the worst case scenario in every respect. And I think in some cases he just the simple fact of human nature and of unintended consequences depresses his analysis to the extent that it kind of flattens it out. I don't think he's alive to all the ways, for example, radio was used and every technological medium ever invented has been used for good purposes and evil purposes. And I think that the web still has yet to assert itself even more strongly in the cause of freedom and democracy.
Thanks a lot, Lee.
Thank you.
That's Lee Siegel, who reviews The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler's here with bestseller news, and I mean news, and actually bestseller lists news. Tell us about it, Jenny.
Yes, it's, you know, normally you ask me what's new on the list, and this week the lists are new. We are rolling out, after much preparation, a sort of revamped set of lists. All of the lists are redesigned, and most interestingly, there are two entirely new lists. For the first time, the New York Times is publishing an e-books bestseller list, long awaited for, much clamored for. And we also have something called the combined list, which basically rolls together sales in all categories, e-books, hardcover, trade paperback, mass market paperback. And what this does is basically gives us a snapshot of which books people really just want to plunk down money for in whatever format.
And what are we learning from these lists? What are they telling us so far? You're our snapshot expert. What are you saying here?
Well, in a weird way, in terms of the patterns, there's sort of no news. I mean, what it shows is that the books that are selling really strongly in hardcover and paperback are also selling really strongly in ebooks. What we don't have are any kind of surprise ebook-driven hits. You know, James Patterson, he's got a new book this week. It's called TikTok. He's on top of the fiction list, hardcover fiction list, the combined fiction list, and the ebook list.
And Jenny, what about Stieg Larsson? He's another titan of the bestseller lists.
Yeah, he's everywhere. He's number 2, 3, and 4 on the combined list. The third novel, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, is still on the hardcover fiction list. He's very high up on the trade paperback and mass market paperback list. You know, this guy is dominating on every form, you know, short of microchips implanted directly into your brain.
So the rich get richer.
Same story on the nonfiction side. Interestingly, there's a little more variety there. Laura Hillenbrand still rules all the lists with her book Unbroken. It's on the nonfiction combined list, top of the nonfiction hardcover list, and top of the ebooks list. It's obviously not available yet in paperback. Interestingly, what the combined list does show is kind of the relative strength of paperback sales. Like, for example, the number 2 title on the combined list is a book called Heaven is for Real by Lynn Vincent. It's the top seller in trade nonfiction. So it slides in there ahead of Amy Chua's Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, you know, a hardcover title, number 2 on the hardcover list, but only number 3 on the combined list. And in general, these lists are kind of a mashup of new books that are only available in hardcover and books that are a bit older that are circulating in paperback.
Boy, we need some Tim Russert type with his whiteboard to write all the numbers on and erase them. Now, readers will be particularly interested in the new ebook-only bestseller list, the list only of ebook sales. Anything interesting there?
I mean, it's interesting in that it just shows that ebooks aren't really a separate genre. I think there's been a bit of speculation that, oh, you know, certain kinds of books are going to do incredibly well in ebooks. They won't necessarily pop up on the print list, but they're selling tons in ebooks. And this ebooks list that appears in the book review goes down to 25 titles, and I don't see a single title that isn't on one of the regular old lists.
Jenny, one question a lot of people are going to have is just what volume of books being bought are now being bought as ebooks? Are the ebooks numbers a lot lower than the print numbers? Do we have any sense of that? Can we compare them? Whether a big book is doing most of its sales in print and only a tiny fraction on ebooks, is that something we'll be looking at in the days ahead?
Well, this week, leading off the pages of the bestseller list is this really cool graphics generated by the bestseller people downstairs. And it shows the top 10 fiction titles on the combined list. So these are sales of all kinds. And it shows where they rank in terms of ebook sales and in terms of print sales, hardcover and paperback. And generally, there aren't a lot of anomalies here. You know, James Patterson, again, number one on in print and ebooks. Stieg Larsson, Girl with Dragon Tattoo, number two, etc. You know, we get down to number five, Sarah Gruen's novel, Water for Elephants, a huge bestseller a few years ago. It's on top of the trade paperback list because of the new movie. It's number five in ebooks, as it is on the combined list, but only number seven in print. Interestingly, John Grisham, he's at number six on the ebooks list, but only number 26 on the combined print list. This is partly because he's only in hardcover, not in paperback yet. We're going to be talking a lot more numbers from now on, Sam. The thing that was really striking to me, does not appear printed in the book review, but the bestseller people did give me some information about the ratio of ebook to print sales. It's often said that across the board, the total book market is about 10% ebooks at this point, growing pretty quickly. But what you see for these top sellers is levels of ebook sales are much higher. Typically, for the fiction titles, ebook sales are half or anywhere up to 60-70% of total sales. Quite amazing.
That is a dramatic rise.
Yeah, for Grisham, for example, 75% of the sales of The Confession came in ebook form. Nonfiction ebook sales are a bit lower proportionally, but they're still 30-40%. And then you have some kind of really weird anomalies. Like, for example, Alexander Horowitz's book, Inside of a Dog, it's number two on the nonfiction paperback list, a really great book, I think, about dog psychology and the mind of the dog, you know, sold incredibly well. It isn't even on the top 35 ebook titles. For some reason, this book is not generating a lot of ebook sales. I have no idea why. Maybe dogs eat Kindles. Mm-hmm. But you don't see a lot of those anomalies. But on the whole, ebooks are a big proportion of sales for new books.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.